Morning, everyone. Our first reading today comes from Exodus chapter 14, verses 19 to 31. The angel of God, who was going before the Israelite army, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from in front of them and took its place behind them. It came between the army of Egypt and the army of Israel. And so the cloud was there with the darkness, and it lit up the night. One did not come near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. The Israelites went into the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went into the sea after them, all of the Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and chariot drivers. At the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and cloud looked down upon the Egyptian army and threw the Egyptian army into panic. He clonked their chariot wheels so that they turned with difficulty. The Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for the Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and chariot drivers." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at dawn the sea returned to its normal depth. As the Egyptians fled before it, the Lord tossed the Egyptians into the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the chariot drivers. The entire army of the Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the Israelites walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great work that the Lord did against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Our second reading comes from Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 to 35. At that point, Peter got up the nerve to ask, "Master, how many times do I forgive a brother or sister who hurts me? Seven?" Jesus replied, "Seven? Hardly. Try 70 times seven." The kingdom of God is like a king who decided to square accounts with his servants. As he got underway, one servant who brought before him had run up a debt of $100,000. He couldn't pay up, so the king ordered the man, along with his wife, children, and goods, to be auctioned off at the slave market. The poor wretch threw himself at the king's feet and begged, "Give me a chance and I'll pay it back." Touched by his plea, the king let him off, erasing the debt. The servant was no sooner out of the room when he came upon one of his fellow servants who owed him $10. He seized him by the throat and demanded, "Pay up now." The poor wretch threw himself down and begged, "Give me a chance and I'll pay it all back." But he wouldn't do it. He had him arrested and put in jail until the debt was paid. When the other servants saw this going on, they were outraged and brought a detailed report to the king. The king summoned the man and said, "You evil servant, I forgave your entire debt when you begged me for mercy. Shouldn't you be compelled to be merciful to your fellow servant who asked for mercy?" The king was furious and put the screws to the man until he paid back his entire debt. And that's exactly what my Father in heaven is going to do to each of you who doesn't forgive unconditionally anyone who asks for mercy. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Hugh, and thank you to everyone who's helping with the service today, for Colin on the organ, Heather who's running slides, Brian who's doing sound, and Alexander who's doing video. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the chariot drivers, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained, but the Israelites walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. Let's pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our strength and our liberator. Amen. I've titled this sermon, Foundational Stories We Tell Ourselves. Foundational Stories We Tell Ourselves. Every people, every culture, every nation, every generation, every religion and denomination has stories we tell ourselves that help to create our common identity as a group and our sense of self-worth as individuals. As Methodists, we learn the story of John Wesley, whose heart was strangely warmed and who gained a renewed faith and sense of purpose one night in 1738 that sustained his life as a travelling preacher and advocate for the poor. We forget that before this event, Wesley had already been an ordained Anglican priest for many years. Didn't he have a strong faith already? And just the previous year, he had led, failed to establish, and retreated from a mission in the American colonies. Nonetheless, we gain impetus and encouragement to live good Christian lives ourselves from the way Wesley lived out his life and ministry. We take to heart his homily that we should do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. And his mantra about money: earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. These are worthy ideals, and we do our best, but they're very hard to live up to in real life. Creation stories are important. There are two separate creation stories in Genesis. In the Maori legend of Maui fishing up the great fish that is the North Island, Wellington Harbour is the mouth of the fish that swallowed Maui's hook. Here we trace their legacy in this country back to the seven great waka that brought their ancestors from Hawaiki maybe 600 or 700 years ago. What are some of the foundational stories or legends that you can think of that are important for our identity in this country today? Yes. And who was the first country to have give women the vote? Other things in our early history that we look back to, maybe. I had in mind things like the Anzacs, a failed military campaign, but one of the first times that internationally people identified themselves as New Zealanders, not migrants from Scotland or England or Ireland or wherever, but as New Zealanders, as Kiwis. So that's part of who we are today. For me, I was part of the nuclear-free movement, very pleased when the Longy Labor government enacted that. But then on the other side, Roger Douglas put in place a lot of very conservative right-wing financial policies that created distress for people. So there's always a balance in these things. The story of the parting of the Red Sea that we acted out earlier is a key part of the story of the Exodus from Egypt and out onto the Promised Land that's foundational for the Jewish people. And the whole Old Testament or Hebrew Scriptures has an overarching theme of God being their God and they being God's people. They worship one God, God protects them. There's a repeated pattern, however, of people drifting away from God and worshipping other gods. God being about to punish the people, and then a leader of the people pleading for forgiveness and God forgiving them. Let's set the scene and look at some of the details of the story from Exodus chapter 14. The events take place around 1300 BC, or 3,300 years ago. Israelite slaves, descendants of Abraham, are forced to toil in back-breaking, brick-making, and construction work in Egypt. God calls Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. Pharaoh refuses to let them go. God brings 10 plagues on Egypt, the last being the killing of all the firstborn, children and animals. The Israelite firstborn are spared, and the angel of death passes over their houses. Pharaoh then gives Moses permission to lead his people out of Egypt, and they set off into the Sinai Desert. But a bit later, Pharaoh realizes that he needs the Israelites as his workforce, and sends his army to try to capture the Israelites and bring them back to Egypt. So we now have the Israelites on foot somewhere on the Sinai Peninsula close to the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army of chariots and horse-riding soldiers is closing in on them. The Israelites can't backtrack as the way is cut off by the Egyptian army. The only way forward to escape the Egyptians is the Red Sea. Now, the Bible earlier told us that there are 600,000 Israelite men, let's say 2 million people, including women and children. They can't swim across the sea, and anyway, it's too deep. It's too far. Moses appeals to God to save them. God tells Moses that what he needs to do is lift high his staff, the Red Sea will part, and the Israelites will be able to walk across the dry seabed. When the Egyptian army are all on the seabed following the Israelites, God will close up the sea behind them and the Israelites and drown the Egyptians and their horses. The angel of God and a pillar of fire move from the front of the Israelites to the back. So they're between the Israelites and the Egyptians. This gives the Israelites a breather that night. Next morning, Moses raises his staff. The sea parts, and the Israelites cross safely. The Egyptian army chases them. God, as the pillar of fire, looms over the Egyptians, who get scared and try to retreat back out of the sea. God then tells Moses to raise his staff again, and the sea closes on the Egyptians, who are all drowned. Why did the Egyptians pursue the Israelites across the seabed when they must have realized that there was a great danger that God would not let them cross? Here's a link to our reading from Matthew's Gospel about forgiveness. In verse 17 of Exodus chapter 14, just a bit before today's reading, God tells Moses that, "I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so that they will go in after them, and so I will gain glory for myself over Pharaoh and all his army, his chariots and his chariot drivers. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained glory for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots and his chariot riders." Forgiveness does not come from hardened hearts. I'm going to see the first slide here. On the front cover of your orders of service. It's a spectacular picture, and that's kind of the sort of image I get from a children's illustrated Bible as a child. It's a dramatic story, dramatic scene. No one today is exactly sure where the crossing of the Red Sea took place. There's a tradition that the crossing place might be close to Migdol on the eastern side of the Sinai Peninsula. And if we go to the next slide. Okay. So I've got an arrow pointing down to Migdol, just at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, in the Red Sea there, and up into the Arabian Peninsula, and further up into Israel. But there's a practical problem with this location. It would take a long time for 2 million people going at the pace of their slowest members, small children, the elderly, and the sick, to pick their way across the rough rocks of the seabed. And there's a problem with the idea that the wind blowing strongly from one direction, the east in this case, could part the waters in the way the story tells us. Yes, strong wind can build big waves, but the story is unlikely to be factual. So how might this have risen? Oh, just one thing to note. Mount Sinai, which I've arrowed there, is on the Arabian Peninsula. It's on this side of the Red Sea, according to the tradition that this map reader has given us. Next slide, please. So how might this story have arisen? On some shallow, smaller lakes, the wind can have the effect of blowing water away from the shore and exposing some of the lake bed. One place this happens a bit is Little Bitter Lake at the top of the Suez, Gulf of Suez, which I've arrowed there. So it's in between Egypt and Sinai. There's a big lake and there's a smaller one where people have noted that happens. And this is much closer to Ramesses in Egypt, which is just above that arrow there, where the Israelites might have set out from. So that's another possibility. Another clue is that in the Hebrew text of the Exodus narrative, Yam Suf, Y-A-M-S-U-P-H, is the body of water which the Israelites crossed following their escape from Egypt. But rather than Red Sea, first used in the King James translation from 1611, a better translation of the Hebrew text is Sea of Reeds, not Red Sea, but Sea of Reeds. So instead of open sea, the crossing point may have been more like a tidal estuary or wetland or swamp, and there's plenty of that sort of land in Egypt, closer to the Mediterranean. And the crossing of the Red Sea may have had a basis in fact. Writers such as Simon Shamer in his book The History of the Jews and John Spong in his recent book about Matthew's Gospel suggest there could have been several exoduses of small groups of Israelites escaping or migrating from Egypt east into the Holy Land. One of these small groups could have been pursued, wading through swampy land by more heavily clad and armed Egyptian soldiers who got bogged down and couldn't catch them. Several hundred years before the stories in Exodus were compiled and written down. And a good small story gets added to and exaggerated as it's passed on. Note the location of Mount Sinai on this map. So the interpretation of the people who've compiled this is that Mount Sinai is at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula, not across the water in Midian. The last slide, there's one more. We come forward 3,000 or so years, and we can see the probable location of the Sea of Reeds in this area here. It's now close to the Suez Canal, which I've marked in blue. The truth about these stories from Exodus is that we're not sure where they took place and exactly what happened. But like all foundational stories, they are still powerful and memorable. If you turn that slide off, please. In our reading from Matthew's Gospel this morning, we have Jesus telling a straightforward parable that we are told is just a story. So we can relax and think about what it might mean for us. The golden rule that we should treat other people the way we would like them to treat us is universal, in one form or another, to all the world's religions. Jesus tells us about a man who failed to meet that ideal, who did not treat a person who owed him a tiny sum of money in the generous way that the king had treated him. The man's hard-hearted response to the one who owed him money caused the king to rescind his generous earlier action, harden his heart, and demand full repayment from the man. Fair enough, we would say. The act of living in a faith community, being part of a family, or interacting with our neighbours and people in our wider community may at some stage lead us to treat someone else unfairly, whether on purpose or not. And we also experience unfair treatment from someone else too. Hardened hearts will lock in the conflict and prevent a resolution. Offering and accepting forgiveness lets us start afresh, to put the issue behind us and move on with our lives. Peter, always the one to test Jesus, suggests that forgiving the other person seven times should be enough. Jesus says, no, 70 times seven, 490 times. The message to us is clear. Shortly, we're going to pray the version of the Lord's Prayer that appears in Matthew chapter 6. Note the emphasis given to forgiveness, especially of debts. But there is one situation where we should be careful about advocating forgiveness. I'm working on a new book by Trish McBride, who says in it that where someone has been abused by another person, be it physical, sexual, or emotional abuse, telling the victim that they should forgive the abuser can victimize them further. This is especially true in a faith community or church. The victim may, in time, with appropriate support, come to a point where they can forgive the abuser, but this should not be forced on them. What do we think about the God depicted in the story of the parting of the Red Sea, who allows one group of people to go free but causes the deaths of another group of people? In my view, the Bible is not a collection of stories given by God in some form of holy dictation. They are instead stories told and retold, then collected, honed, and written down by people like you and me to describe their relationship with and experience of God. Conflicts will always happen. Forgiveness and warmed hearts provide a way forward and a new start. Jesus shows us the way.